I'm Herndon Shabor Steele, and this is the Prison to Purpose podcast. We believe your past doesn't have to define your purpose. Whether you're a young person trying to make a better decision, a returning citizen looking for hope, or someone who believes every life has value, you are welcome here. This isn't about glorifying prison. It's about showing that every setback can become the foundation for a greater purpose. Transformation is possible. Good morning and welcome to the Prison to Purpose podcast. I'm your host, Herndon Shabor Steele. Before we begin today's conversation, I'd like to tell you a little bit about who I am and why this podcast exists. In 1986, at the age of 21, I was falsely arrested and subsequently wrongly convicted of second-degree murder. Thereafter, I was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole in the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, where I remained for nearly four decades before I was finally able to prove my innocence and was released on March the 13th of 2025. During those years, I experienced the loss of my parents, grandmom, other family members, and I experienced countless moments that could have broken my spirit. But instead, I made a conscious decision that I was determined to not allow my circumstances to define who I was or who I become. Instead of giving in to the bitterness that comes with incarceration, I began to focus on growth, purpose, and the belief that one day I would have the opportunity to make a difference in the lives of others. While I was incarcerated, I was employed as a peer educator in other capacities that allowed me to be a mentor and educator to the younger guys, and was actually through this work that the vision for the Prison to Purpose Foundation was born. It was at that time I told myself and others that when I got out, I would start an organization dedicated to helping at-risk youth make positive choices and responsible decisions that would keep them out of prison and help them to become assets to themselves as well as society. That vision has become a reality. The Prison to Purpose Foundation is committed to violence prevention, mentoring young people, supporting returning citizens, connecting people with resources, and building stronger communities. This podcast is an extension of that mission. Every episode will feature honest conversations with people whose lives demonstrate that transformation is possible. We'll hear from returning citizens, community leaders, educators, advocates, and others who are working every day to create safer neighborhoods and brighter futures. And I want to be very clear about something. This isn't a podcast about glorifying prison. It's about showing that every life has value, every person deserves an opportunity to change, and every setback can become the foundation for a greater purpose. So whether you're a young person trying to make a better decision, or a returning citizen looking for hope, or a family member supporting someone you love, or simply someone who believes that returning citizens deserve a second chance, and our youth deserve a better first chance, you are welcome here. I'm Herndon Shabor Steele, and this is the Prison to Purpose podcast, where we believe your past does not have to define your future, and every journey can lead to purpose. Today, we're joined by returning citizen Celine Rouse, who has agreed to share his journey openly and honestly. Me and Celine was actually neighbors on the same block at SCI Mahanoy for many, many years, and so we share a special bond. You know, we ate together, we prayed together, we laughed together, we cried together, we worked out together, we played ball together. I mean, this was my companion in prison, and he's my companion out here. And oftentimes in prison, you have to be careful about the relationships that you foster, because a lot of those relationships are built on ulterior motives. And throughout my nearly four decades of incarceration, I can honestly say that I've always felt a sincere level of brotherhood from a man, Celine. So without further ado, and welcome Celine to the show. Celine, tell the listeners a little about yourself, your background, and your journey before prison.
It's an old nigga, bro. My journey before prison, I was 19 years old when I was arrested, when a SWAT team wrongfully ran in my crib and snatched me out of it, right? I was 19, so before that, I had like the typical upbringing of any other young black male living in the hood.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I went to Edward T. Steele School. That was my elementary school. Then I went to Central East Middle School. Then I went to Alney High School. Then I went to I went to Edison, and then finally I went to Gratz High School, and then that's where actually where I was arrested while I was still enrolled there. But the upbringing was typical. I was a people see me happy go lucky now. I was always that. Mm-hmm. That wasn't like what you see on Instagram. That's who I really am, like right. in real life. So I'm not putting on a facade mm-hmm. for the gram or for the social media. Like, this is who I really be. That's why it's easy for me to do it. But my upbringing was school, basketball. Then you know I was influenced by the wrong things, like typically.
And that was my next question, like who? Because I grew up in South Philadelphia, as you know. And growing up in the inner city, we tend to gravitate toward the negative influences. You know, I had my negative influences. Who would you say had the biggest influence on your life? Was it a group of people? You know,
my biggest negative influence mm-hmm. was the hustlers in the hood.
Exactly.
The neighborhood hustlers. And they will remain nameless.
No, right, absolutely.
The neighborhood hustlers,
absolutely,
and drug dealers and all of that, right? Those were the biggest negative influences because, you know, as young impressionable youth, mm-hmm. we seen what we thought was success,
right, right.
With them, with their cars and the mm-hmm. women and mm-hmm. you know the money and. You know, all that we seen that, and we seen how they was obtaining that. So we thought that, you know, okay, we can go. We're gonna take that same path. Mm-hmm. So those were the biggest negative influences were the people in my neighborhood who was quote unquote winning mm-hmm. at drug dealing.
Right, right, you know right.
Those were the biggest negative influences.
And so, because of those negative influences, that you developed that, you know, that peer pressure. You know, amongst your peers, was because y'all looked up to them guys.
Right.
So, you know, you felt the pressure of being in inner city and you wanted to be just like them. Like, just like inner city kids feel nowadays. They feel peer pressure and negative peer pressure from the people who they see in the neighborhood, who they see winning, who got the bag, as they say today.
Right. Right.
Right. So, looking back, when you look back, what would you say were the circumstances that led to your wrongful arrest?
Well, it's crazy because, like, I was literally in the process of purchasing marijuana when the police just scooped us all up. Like, they just did a little net. They did a little net of anybody that was in a certain perimeter. They were just grabbing you all up, and I literally was in the process of buying marijuana to feed my marijuana addiction. Mm-hmm. So, you know. I look back on it, like it's like, you know, although I was wrongfully convicted,
right.
I still was doing something that was wrong.
Right.
I still
right.
was doing something right. that was wrong. I was, right. you know, and, you know, you always look back and say, well, if I wasn't there, then that, you know what I mean? But you mm-hmm. know, as Muslims, you know, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. But it's still a reflection, nevertheless. Mm-hmm. If I'm saying so, that you know, so I could say, like, it was my addiction
right.
that
right.
led to. Me being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right. So as a young kid, I'm sure you had dreams of, you know, who you wanted to become. Outside of the hustlers and the drug dealers, like young kids, they want to be ball players. Nowadays they want to be rappers. I wanted to be a ball player. And I, you know, that was my skill that I had. Did you have like one particular skill that you could say, well, maybe I could do this later on in life? But you just got derailed from that for whatever reason.
What I wanted to be when I was younger was a basketball player.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a basketball player. Even as a youth, I was always known for my defense. I was always known for my defense, even as youth. And one of my, you know, everybody wanted to be like Mike, right? Everybody wanted to be like Mike. These young boys nowadays, they don't even know who Michael Jordan is. They want to be like Brian. And then now they want to be like Ja, or they want to be like Boogie Brunson, like now. But one of my you know, basketball like icons was Michael Jordan. So, you know, I thought that my path was going to be a basketball path.
Right.
And this comes from my dad. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a point guard for Penn State. Then all of my little, like, even my, it was some key dudes in my circle, even though he was drug dealers, they had vicious ball games.
Right.
So sometimes we'll go out to the park, like, on certain weekend days as a group. We used to go up Mayfair, all the way up the Boulevard, the North East. We used to go up there. We used to play ball at Boney's, right across the street from Gratz, at the Boys and Girls Club, right across the street from Gratz. We used to go over to the park. So we used to, we played ball.
Right.
Played ball. So I wanted to be a ball player until the negative influences, you know, dominated.
Yeah, and that's I was watching something the other day on YouTube. I think it was titled "The Six Players Who Chose the Streets Over the NBA."
I didn't see that.
Oh yeah, you got to watch that. He had the GOAT. All these guys from New York. Nobody from Philly.
Okay.
That I can remember. They had the Mena GOAT, the guy they called the GOAT.
Okay, the GOAT. All right.
Pee Wee Kirkland. Everybody heard Pee Wee Kirkland. And you had guys talk in the NBA. Legends in the NBA who talked about how those guys was better than them. You had college coaches talking about Pee Wee Kirkland was the baddest thing he ever saw. And they said Pee Wee Kirkland, he actually, I think, got drafted by the NBA. He went to a meeting, and they told him you can make $30,000, you know, a year. Pee Wee Kirkland walked out of the meeting. He was making that a week. He literally got up and walked in and walked out of the meeting. So, I mean, but that is part of the reality of growing up in a city. You have talent, whether it's basketball, football, whatever it is, right? But it's other things that derail you from pursuing your goals and your dreams in life. And that's actually one of the things that, you know, I want to try to combat through Prison Purpose Foundation. You know, teaching kids and helping kids to pursue their dreams.
Right.
And to be mindful and to be cautious of the negative peer pressure. Because as you know, and as I know, one wrong decision can alter the whole trajectory of your life.
Absolutely.
You know, and so when you look back, like me, I look back, of course, and we both had time to look back on our life. You know, I had 30 and a half years of incarceration. You was in there for 22 and a half, 23 years incarceration. When you look back, was there any warning signs that you didn't recognize then that you recognize now, that were kind of like telling you and showing you, listen, you're going down the wrong path. You're going down the wrong path. Because we just don't recognize them at that time. Because as they say, when you knee deep in the game, you don't recognize signs. You got tunnel vision. You know, so when you look back, were there any warning signs?
That question reminded me of an answer that Wallow gave, right? Mm-hmm. He gave an answer where he was talking about how, because, you know, now he's doing these skits where he's doing prison, and he's trying to reach the youth through those, like, if you ain't going to listen, you're going to watch this then.
Right.
I ain't going to keep telling y'all don't do it, because y'all always had somebody in y'all past that told y'all don't do this, don't do that, you just kept on doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my aunt. That was my dad. Was literally working 16 hours a day, and so he was in the picture, but because of work, when he pulled up, he had to go to sleep because he had to go back up to work again. So it was my aunt, my grandma, my grandpa. He spoke. He was a man of few words.
Mm-hmm.
He was more hands-on than verbal. He told me, you know, don't be doing this, don't be doing that. But what he did more than that was, because he said that I wasn't listening, he'd just take me fishing. Mm-hmm. I liked it to go fishing. Like, I like fishing.
Right.
So a morning he'd just be like, yo, listen, get in the car. Anytime I get in the car with my grandpa, I know we're going to do something good.
Right, yeah.
So I don't ask no questions. Mm-hmm. He said, get in the car, take a ride. I know we're going someplace, street, we're going to do something fun. And maybe go fishing. You know what I'm saying? So that was his way of pulling me out of, from going to the block.
Right.
Or just doing something.
So your warnings came from family members.
Verbal warnings.
And likewise, like my dad would always tell me, you know, them guys in the street going to get you in trouble. You know what I mean? You know, but I looked at Pop as Pop. You know, my pop was from North Philly.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And I remember one time, you know, he actually got me in a car and took me out North Philly around 20 from Susquehanna, somewhere out that way, and showed me the guys that he grew up with. Right? They were still standing on the corners with wine and all that kind of stuff, where he was a city worker, sanitation department. You know what I mean? And okay. He was warning me, if you don't get away, he got away and made a career for himself. Right, and that was his way of showing me, listen, I'm telling you, pursue what you want to pursue, this basketball thing, because I was good. You knew that from prison.
Nah. I heard about you. But, you still had had a shot even in your 50s. Good, though.
Yeah, but that was his way of warning. I didn't take heed.
Right.
But I also had signs in the street. Not that I was going to be falsely arrested and wrongly convicted of a murder.
Right.
Because that wasn't, you know what I mean? But signs were like the guys I was around getting in trouble. Even when I was in with them, when I look back, that was a sign for me. Look, this guy keep getting in trouble. One day he's going to get in trouble and I'm going to be with him. Mm-hmm. One day he's going to do something, but I don't see it like that. You know what I mean? Until I'm in prison now. And I recognized why it was many signs that told me it was the wrong path and that was the wrong crowd.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so to any youth out there who's listening, you got to take heed to the warning signs and you got to look at them for exactly what they are. Now, if someone had reached you earlier, a mentor, a youth advocate, you know what I mean? One of your old heads that came home from prison and may have pulled you up and talked to you. How do you think you would have responded to that? Do you think that would have had an impact on your life?
If someone would have gotten, if I would have listened earlier.
Right.
Now, this is for the youth right here, right? Because I know y'all all going through this right now.
Mm-hmm.
Where you got people in your ear telling you, don't do this, don't do that, do this. And they talking about doing something good. And then you got the other dudes, right, that's telling you, man, do this, right, which is the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
Had I would have listened, you know, had I would have listened, I guess maybe, you know, I guess what we could say is that we would have arrived at a more positive outcome sooner, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I guess that's the message to the youth is that if you listen now, you can arrive at a better positive outcome sooner.
Right.
You won't have to go through not listening. I mean, taking a risk of not listening. And then end up being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then next thing you know, you got a gang of time.
Absolutely.
Because you're either going to listen now or you're going to listen later. But then again, some dudes don't even listen later. Because we know people upstate that still ain't changing.
Still ain't changing, yeah.
That still ain't changing. You know what I'm saying? They got 30 years. They got 20, 25 in. And you the same dude you was when you came in.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So for the youth out there or for anybody that just, you know, that because, you know, it's about, for the youth, it's about when you change. For the older people, it's about changing as soon as possible.
You gotta change, right, exactly.
It's about changing now, right?
Exactly.
So for the youth, if you listen now, you got a better chance of having a more positive outcome later.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? You got a better chance. It was, and then I reached one youth And it was just off of one conversation. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Oh, hey, I've been seeing you and all. I seen your story, man. I'm dealing with, you know, a lot of drama in the streets." And I said, "How old are you?" He says, 17. He said, "You said give me some advice." I said, because he wanted to go into juicing. Mm-hmm. He's like, "Man, I used to sell juices, man, but then right. You know, I ended up getting into something in the streets and all that. So now I'm like hesitant of, you know, because I want to go out there like how I see you doing it, right?"
Right.
I said, "Hold on, youngin, because if you got some stuff going on out here in these streets, you can't necessarily do the way I'm doing it.
My face
is out there. I'm everywhere without no fear because I don't got no ops.
Right. You could put your whole situation on Instagram.
Right.
You could let people know
where I'm going to be at and all that because ain't nobody looking for me.
Right.
If you got something going on out here in the streets that's drama related, I don't advise you
to do what
I'm doing.
Exactly.
Because somebody I know exactly where you're going to be at or lie like they want some juice and line you up.
Right.
Had you come right there, pull up like how I be doing it, and X, Y, Z. But I still ask Lord to protect me when I'm on my route. Sure, I still ask Lord, "Oh, Lord, protect me when I'm about to go ahead and drive me. Lord, protect me from the evil that I don't see."
Right.
And then I go. Mm-hmm. But I told him, he said, "I don't think I could do that." I said, "But then you gotta leave. You got people in like another state or whatever that could like support you in what it is that whatever you trying to do your future and all that." He's like, "Yeah, I got people that live in XYZ." I said, "Well, I think you need to call them and go out there."
And that's the problem. And I told a young guy the same exact thing. As a matter of fact, I told somebody this from prison that who was on his way out. And, you know, a lot of them young boys in prison now, they got lingering beefs in the street. Mm-hmm. You know, for whatever reason.
Right.
And, you know, young boy confided in me. And, I was talking to him, you know, telling him, how, you know, do the right thing when he go home and, you know, and be a family man. He got 5 kids. Mm. This young guy's 26 years old. he told me, he said, "OG."
I started earlier.
"I got 5 or 4 different women."
Oh, yeah, he running around.
Mm-hmm. He running around. I said, "Listen, when you got an obligation to all 5 of them, first and foremost, you can never fulfill your obligation to your children until you fulfill the obligation you have to yourself. So you have to change."
Right.
"You got any beef?" He said, "I got a lot of beef."
A lot of beef, right.
I said, "Well, you got to relocate."
Yeah.
And you can't look at it as if you're running from anything.
Right, no. But you are.
Yeah, but you can't
look at it like that.
You can't look at it like that. I didn't want to tell him that.
Right.
Because it's an ego thing with these kids nowadays. I don't want to tell him that you're running away, but what I told him is you're saving your life. You're putting yourself in a position where you could be a father. So you have to relocate and start your life over. Well, you're only 26 years old. There's no problem with relocating. But you know, when you tell these kids that nowadays, man, they look at it differently, man. You just have to keep, and you know, you can't give up on them. And that's one of the reasons, another one of the reasons I started this foundation, because I'm not one to give up on kids. We can't give up on them.
Right.
You know, and something I want to clarify, we often refer to youth as at risk, right?
At risk youth. I hear that term a lot.
And when people hear that term, the mind immediately goes to youth that grew up in dysfunctional situations.
Okay.
That they at risk.
Right.
Maybe, and this is the sad reality of it, maybe the mom is getting high, or the dad is getting high, mom is getting high, the dad is in prison, or both getting high. Some kind of dysfunction, you know, is in his life. But that doesn't mean that, I mean, he's at risk, but he's not the only person. You can have a child that comes from a functional family. The mother could be a lawyer, the father a doctor. Parents could be good. He's still at risk. He's still at risk. Yeah. He's at risk of peer pressure.
Peer pressure, right.
Giving into peer pressure.
Negative influences.
Negative influence. He's at risk of making a wrong decision that could alter the trajectory of his life. So he's still at risk, kid. We don't want to stereotype this term at risk and automatically apply it to kids who come from dysfunctional backgrounds.
Right. Nah, but people, their families is addiction.
Right.
And all that. That's what the main one, right?
Yeah, because.
But it's not limited.
It's not limited to that.
Right.
It's not limited to that, right? You know, and not only are they at risk, they are endangered. These kids are in danger. endangered.
Okay.
Like endangered species.
Right, they're endangered species.
You are an endangered group of kids, an endangered generation. And so I believe that it's our job, guys like you and I, who have been in prison, transformed our lives, right? Became who we are in prison. And we have a duty, man, to come out here and try to save these kids, man. That's just my firm belief. I don't think we've both heard the term, to whom much is given, much is required, right? You and I have been given much, and other guys too. We'll address this, but we have been given much, and that's another chance to live in society as productive citizens. Now, because of that, much is required from us. We're not afforded the luxury of just sitting back and not doing nothing. Not that we owe a debt to society, because we don't. You and I were wrongfully convicted. So we don't owe society a debt. I don't look at it like that. But at the same time, we want to contribute to society, not as a debt, because that's who we are.
Right.
We prayed for the chance to come out here and be productive citizens. And now we're out here. And part of being productive, man, is trying to help these youth and save their lives.
I didn't see that youngin for a couple months after I had that talk with him.
Right.
And then he had DM'd me a picture, and he was in another state.
Good. See.
He was in another state. You know what I'm saying? And he just like, you know. One of the, you know, I took heed to what you said.
It's a beautiful thing.
And I'm down here with such and such. If you ever coming down this way, let me know, because we can link up and all that. But
that
people want me, because I never got a chance to meet him. We were just on Instagram. We were just DMing each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, and he actually took heed to it.
That's a beautiful thing. I commend you for that. You actually used that Instagram platform to save his kid's life.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he was all smiling like, I'm down here, yo.
Yeah, to save not only his life, but possibly the life of somebody else.
Right, somebody that'd be attached to him. Maybe his girl or something, or his whoever he be with at the time. Absolutely. where the drama gonna come. Right. You actually removed yourself.
Right, and so, you know, that's a beautiful thing, and I commend you for that. Right. Now let's talk about life inside of prison. 19 years old when you was falsely arrested, subsequently convicted of murder.
CFCF.
And sentenced to life without the possibility of parole in the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Just let that sink in for a minute, because that's something serious. That is for a night. That's I was 21. Same age, basically.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So your very first day in prison, what was that like?
It was an eye opener.
Yeah.
It was an eye opener, man, because you know, the first time that I've been the eighth in race was for this case. Mm. And I've been eighth race ever before. I've never been to the roundhouse before until this happened. So that was the first thing, was eighth in race. And you know, I've been locked up before and been in precincts and all that, but I get bailed out and then I'm out.
Right.
But that one right there was no bail.
Yeah.
So I wasn't leaving. So now I had to spend the night, and until they came in the morning and all that, then took me to CFCF. This is my first time at the F, but it's not my first time on state road. I had other little drug cases and that, and I went to the House of Corrections.
Right.
But this is my first time at CFCF. And going through quarantine and it was a crazy joint. What made this joint crazy was because the person that gave a false statement against me.
Right.
I was on, when I went to the quarantine, he was on quarantine with me.
Mm.
Right. And I didn't, like, when the detectives had, you know, When the SWAT team hit my crib and they grabbed me, and one of the first things they said was that such and such told us that you did this, so you don't got to tell us nothing, right? So I'm like,
wow.
I said, yeah. So when I get to quarantine and CFCF, I see such and such,
right?
I see him. So, and although I didn't have no paperwork yet, because I'm literally on quarantine, so I don't get no paperwork yet. I don't even got a lawyer yet. I just got the charges.
Right.
I remember what the detective said. So I get on quarantine, outside of the fact that it's my first time here, it's a crazy situation. So before I could even absorb the reality of where I'm at, I couldn't do that because I seen this dude, right?
Yeah.
I seen this dude.
Right.
So I'm like, I see him, he don't see me. I see him, they lining up for the meal. You gotta line up on the steps, and then you gotta like go up the steps, and you got there's a line. Go back to the down the steps. So when I see him, I'm like, I know that ain't bro. I see him, he don't see me. Get the meal. I see the cell. He went in at the mill. Boom! I went in the cell. Yo, they saying you said X, Y, and Z.
Right.
That's impossible for that to have occurred. I wasn't even with you. So why was they even saying this?
Right.
He said, I don't know. They lying. I don't know what they talking about. That ain't the case. Like you wasn't even with me. I know. So why are they saying that though?
Yeah, exactly.
Short story short, he lied to me, right? Mm-hmm. He lied because when I get my paperwork later on,
he
got the longest statement in there, right? All lies. But to get back to the question, it was after I got past that, I was able to. I went to hold on, wait a minute. So I talked to him for a little bit. Once he said he ain't do it or whatever, I'm like, all right. So we just start busting up about this other stuff. You know, time to go in. We got to lock in. You know, I go back to myself. We lock in. Next morning, I'm thinking I'm going to go see him again. I go back to his cell next morning. They moved him.
Yeah, yeah.
Gone.
Yeah.
He was gone. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I said, it was too fast.
Right.
His cellie, like, I don't know who he was, but, like high-ranking staff members came and got him out of the cell this morning.
Wow.
So they came and got him. It was a crazy joint. It was a crazy joint.
At that point, did you say, man, that guy?
He said something.
Wow.
He had to say something. You know what I'm saying? And he got off that block because he knew he said something.
Right.
I just didn't know he said something at the time.
Right.
I just went off of what he said to me.
To you, right.
But then once his Sully was like, Them people came and got him out of the joint. That's my first thing. But they must have realized that we was on the same unit, or he must have said something.
Yeah,
like, I got to get off this block. And they came and pulled him. They came basically extracted him.
And I'm inclined to believe that he said something, because had they known prior, they wouldn't have put you on the same unit with
him. Exactly.
So once you got by that part of it,
and then I was able to absorb the reality of where I'm at.
What was your biggest adjustment at that point?
Well, I was still dealing with addiction.
Yeah.
Right? I was still dealing with addiction. I wasn't Muslim, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I still was dealing with addiction. So I was trying to escape my reality.
Right. Yeah.
So I was taking Cinequans. That's back then. So you know that. That was 2002.
Wow.
I was taking them, trying to escape the reality, because that's what everybody was using to get high outside of smoking weed and all that stuff, whatever. But when I'm sober, now I'm dealing with the situation. I'm still trying to figure out, like, where I'm at, how this whole jail thing go, as far as, like, now I'm really in jail. Like, even though I was in house correction, I was on there for like 2 weeks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a little. I don't even think I made it to the store. Matter of fact, no, I was there for a week. I don't even think I made it to the store.
Right.
At house corrections, the first time I got out there, but this time it was an extended stay.
Mm-hmm.
So once I had to deal with the reality of where I'm at and the situation that I found myself in, it was. It was crazy.
It had to be, and because it was for me. So, like, the emotional highs and lows of it all.
Now, you got emotional highs and lows from the county, then you got the ones in the state. I think it's different levels.
Oh, explain.
I think it's the different levels, because I'm not mature yet. I'm okay. 19.
Right.
I'm, you know, just before it slammed. So, I didn't know how to handle it emotionally yet.
Right.
In the county. I didn't know how to handle my situation emotionally. I wasn't crying or anything like that. I was just trying to figure out how I'm going to get up out of this situation.
Right.
Feel what I'm saying?
Right.
So, but the county is gladiator school. It's gladiators. Yeah. I don't care nobody say. The county was more dangerous than the state.
Yeah, you was at CFCF?
I was at CFCF.
Yeah, I was in way more
situations in the county than I had been upstate. And I did 20, let me see. I was in the county from 2002 to 2005. And I went from upstate from 2005 to 2025.
We got the same year. Two weeks away from when we got out.
So, and I've been in more incidents in that 3-year span in the county than I would ever been in the 20 years of state.
Yeah.
That's just so it was different. It was different, man. You see dudes get stabbed up over in the prayer and I done seen dudes, you know, going to Jumwa wearing books.
Oh man, bulletproof vests.
They wear their vests.
Yeah.
So I'm like, hold on. I took my jihad and then if I came into that, but it was gladiator school. It was gladiator school, man. And I was young. I was still impressionable. But then you know, that's how I met all the dudes that I deal with now. Mm. As far as like all the Celine Bays and the Cook Jesus and all these guys. I met these guys.
That's my nephew, man. Shout out to Celine Bays.
You know, absolutely no doubt. Man, Lord, make it easy for him and release you from this situation. That means you know. So I met all these guys in the county, and then. Upstate, you know, we all got convicted and came up top, and then, you know what I mean, but it was gladiator school.
Yeah.
So it was gladiator school. Let me ask you,
was there ever a time that you lost hope? Now, you had a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Was there ever a time that you lost hope?
I lost hope one time.
Mm-hmm.
I lost hope one time. And you know the time that was.
Right.
And that was, what's that, 2023, I believe? Or 2021. It was one of the other when I got that.
That letter
from the federal court. So I didn't lose hope until 2021 or 23. So we talking about 2002 to 2000. We talking about 19 to 21 years later.
Yeah.
But the very first time I ever lost hope. And when I got that letter, and it was like, this case is closed, the case is closed.
I still tell people that. In fact, I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day. Brother called me from prison.
I'm there, okay.
Mm-hmm. And they had a deal on the table for him. And with this new thing with the AG, want to look through everything and all that now, the deal was removed, taken off the table. And, you know, he's human. Guys are human. And so naturally, you know what I mean? It causes some, you know, a sense of not despair. Hopelessness, but despair. Exactly. Despair. Exactly.
Go from a deal
and
to being
told him, I used this your situation. I've used it often.
Okay. Okay.
And I told him, I said, I know a brother, man, who they sent him a letter. Literally, I've never seen this. It was the first time I've ever seen that. Letter they sent you saying this case is closed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It don't get no more plain and simple than that. This place is closed.
Denied. Case closed. Is closed for statistical purposes.
And I told him exactly what I told you at that time.
Okay. Nah. Right.
That they are not in charge of this affair.
No doubt.
I told you that, bro.
Yeah. Nah.
They are not. Yeah. They cannot. When the law sends down his verdict from above, this is what we believe as Muslims.
Right.
You know, and that's with any religion.
Right, nah.
We don't believe that humans have the control of anything that goes on in the universe.
Right, they only got control to a certain extent.
To a certain extent. But if Lord and Creator decrees a matter for you, as you come home, you're going to come. Nobody can stop that. You know what I mean? And he said, well, I understood it. He said, I know that, but I just needed to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Right, nah.
You know, reminder benefits
nah.
us.
Nah.
And he just needed to hear it. And so I can see how at that particular time, I was there with you, bro.
Right. That was the only time I ever lost hope.
But we cried together.
We cried at the door. I remember that. We cried at the door. I ain't gonna cry right here on this podcast. But we cried in that jail, unit.
Yeah.
SCI Monahoy, yeah. Outside of 25 cell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
In the corner.
Man. In the corner,
in front of the closet, they got the tissue and all that
I
in there.
I'll never forget. I hugged you, man. I kissed you. And I said, brother, listen, man, they don't have
control.
They
have the control, bro.
It made me cry to see because I knew, right. I understood what you was going through.
Like, and I just got divorced. I just lost my wife. It was an accumulation of things.
Sure.
And that right there was the one time where I was like, oh, man.
So let me ask. So what was the moment? What was the moment in prison that changed your life? The change, not in your life, but your way of thinking.
Okay. My way of thinking was changed. The beginning of my change of thinking was when I actually read the Quran for the first time.
Mm. That's powerful. That's strong. Yeah.
When I read the entire Quran for the first time, that's when I knew my whole train of thought was jacked up.
Mm-hmm.
First time I ever read it, and I always wanted to know, like, why this ain't reached me sooner, right?
right.
It actually did reach me sooner, yeah. But I was on the streets,
right? Yeah,
and
yeah.
I couldn't gravitate to
right,
it
because right,
I'm
right.
young. I'm 17, 18. I ain't got time for it. I'm running around. I'm partying. I'm getting high. I'm selling drugs.
I'm
doing anything I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I got the women. I don't got time to be talking about
right.
Assalamualaikum.
Right.
That was how it was back then. I got some companions right now that live 3 blocks away from Mecca.
Mm, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So
that's where you and I'll be going at pretty soon together.
We had it booked, but then
that stuff happened.
They shot the stuff down and we couldn't go.
Yeah.
But so my train of thought, the beginning of that transformation came when I actually read the Quran for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I realized, like, oh, my whole drink was jacked up. My whole drink was. That's when I knew I had to change. That's when I knew right there.
So, what is it that actually, or who is it that actually played a role? Would you say it was in your transformation, like faith or educator or a particular mentor you met in prison, or, you know, because that happens. You know, something has to happen for the transformation to become full scale, right? So,
what
was it that actually played the most important role, actually, like that, in your transformation?
I think it was a combination of them all.
Mm-hmm.
You said, what were those examples
your
you gave?
Faith. Educator, a counselor.
Yeah,
a mentor who was an inmate at that particular time.
Exactly.
Whatever the case may be, but you know.
It was a combination of all of them. Mm-hmm. It was my faith, first and foremost. It was the verse that led to me thinking differently was the verse about change. Allah will not change condition of people until they change what is in themselves.
Mm-hmm,
It was that one. That was the verse. I'm like, yo. Yeah,
you wanted your condition to change.
I wanted my condition right. to change, yeah, right?
Right.
And so it was a combination of all those things: faith, counselors up there, mm-hmm. right? The specific counselor that we had, our psych that was on the block.
Charlie's a good guy.
Man, Charlie knows so much intimate stuff about me, man.
Yeah.
And
me too.
I know some intimate stuff about him too.
Right,
you know what
right,
I'm saying?
Right.
So, but Charlie was one of the first people I talked to after I talked to you.
Mm.
I went to talk to Charlie, man, and Charlie was like, he said, well, don't give up hope on your faith. He was a Muslim.
Right.
Don't give up hope on your faith.
Right.
And there's also this second degree thing that's coming down the pipe.
Right.
X, Y, Z. So boom. So we got in, you know, we had some intimate talks. And now look, the second degree thing popped off, right?
Absolutely.
But,
absolutely.
And outside of that, then we got the prison mentors. You was one of them.
Sure,
you was like let me see. Who was before you? Because I met you after the fact. So who was before you? Was it
was I there with the guy?
Yeah, Turk Turner.
Turk. Turk Turner.
This is, I first came into jail. He was waiting on me.
He's legal guy.
He was waiting on me, man. Because a couple of my old heads from my hood, he was talking to on the phone. He told them, like, yo, my youngin is coming up there. So when I came up there, Turk like, yo, you such and such and such. I'm like, yeah. He like, well, I'm such and such. I talked to main man, and he told me to look out for you, XYZ. And he was the first ones.
That's good.
He was the first ones from the legal standpoint. Because yeah, I don't think he was Muslim. Right. He was the first one from the legal thing. Mm-hmm. He's like, listen, you got life, man. Don't forget that.
Yeah, that's something old heads. Do not forget that, man.
Something
old heads told me when I come through Greater Fort, man. You know, I know you like to play ball. Right. Get off that court. And one last question before we end this segment. So now we're in prison. You got life, and you working hard on your case. You esteemed jailhouse attorney.
Right.
I know that. You know. Right. How did you when your freedom became like? Really, it's going to be a reality apparent. For you now.
Mm-hmm.
Came apparent for you. You going home. How did you mentally prepare yourself for that?
Well, my attorneys at the Abolitionist Law Center, Brett Grody, Nia Holston, Rupali Rashatwar, Salim Holbrook.
Mm-hmm.
They told me like it's gonna happen.
It's gonna happen. It's gonna happen. Right,
so,
right.
And they gave me about, I had like a year to when they were talking about the negotiations and all that. Mm-hmm. Well, look, we in negotiations right now with district attorney's office. They already said they're going to agree to your relief. They already said they're going to agree to your relief because your co-defendant has already been released. So okay. It's just about you need to start getting your affairs in order.
Oh, right.
So
right.
I had like a year.
Okay. That's a lot of time to get it together,
mm-hmm. And it was a shock to my family.
Right, and we're going to talk about that.
It was a shock to them, because I've been telling them I'll come home the whole 20. I'll be home next year. Then I tell other women that I met throughout the decades, yeah. I'll be home. You know, in 2 years, mm-hmm. extended age, 2 years. I did that, but so. The adjustment. Well, I had time.
Okay.
I had time to put some affairs in order.
That's good.
That
made things easier for you, and that's a good thing. And so, in closing, you know, what we take from this is that prison can take away your freedom, but it can't take away your purpose.
Right.
You can still live your purpose.
Right. No.
In prison, and so in the next segment we'll talk about. Coming home and rebuilding life after incarceration.
Still trying to do that now,
right?
Oh, man.
And so we want to thank you, man, for this segment. We thank our listeners. And until the next time, everybody be safe.